I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite radio stories. In this issue of The Urbanite, someone who I've interviewed a few times and ran into more than a few times here in our city is back for another interview because he was in The Urbanite talking about his next move he's about to make. The article is called Hard to Swallow by Michael Amft. School lunch guru Tony Gerassi steps out amid dashed expectations. Is that what's real? We'll talk about that. Tony Gerassi, food and nutrition director was your title, right?
Still is.
I'm sorry, man.
Yeah.
Welcome. Good to see you.
You know, all of these reports of my death are premature.
You don't look dead to me.
Yeah. No, first of all, thanks for having me on.
It's always great to see you.
You know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm in the process of making some changes in my life personally and professionally, and one of those changes is stepping back as the full-time food service director for Baltimore City Public Schools. My role here was to get things started, build it, and start putting people in place to operationalize the work that's been happening. And we're on target. We're on point on that.
Well, there's a lot to cover. I do want to cover it's been 2 years, right?
Yeah.
And some of the things we talked about in the beginning, the middle, and now this period when you're kind of shifting, but still will be involved, but shifting in larger issues about school lunches, because as my 13-year-old says, she always attempts to organize the students in her school, which is not in Baltimore, but in her school, to rally against the miserable food.
Good for her.
In her school district. But when you came here, there were 215 school kitchens, and there were about 159 or 60 school kitchens, at least, where all the food was prepared. Nothing was cooked on site.
Correct.
Has that changed at all?
Yeah, that's changed completely. So
completely?
Yeah. As of this coming school year, we're starting to cook on site in the kitchens that are cooking capable. So you have to understand that of the 200-plus schools in Baltimore City Public Schools, there's maybe like 20 operational kitchens that are capable of even cooking. All right, so they've over the course of
20 out of 215,
yeah,
are the only ones capable of cooking a meal
actually
from scratch.
Cooking a meal from scratch. You know, everything else, they're all like warming stations. You know, and that was part of a grander plan that a lot of school systems, and not just Baltimore, that a lot of school systems sort of put into place because it made more sense. They sort of listened to a lot of the industry giants saying, oh my God, you're going to kill children if you cook chicken for them, buy these nuggets. They're pre-cooked, and the only thing you have to do is warm them up.
Who did that? Where's that come from?
Largely that came from the food manufacturing industry.
The people who manufacture the processed foods that you buy in the frozen counter.
So there's a thing called value add, all right? So here's the story with value add. So the government gives each school system, you know, a certain amount of free food, right? So you have raw bone-in chicken. So if you no longer have the capability of cooking raw bone-in chicken, what do you do with this raw bone-in chicken? You send it to the processor, I won't name names, but there are big chicken processors around, right? And then those guys do a thing where they give you 135% return on what you're giving them. So in other words, if you give them 1,000 pounds of raw chicken, they're going to return to you 1,350 pounds of chicken nuggets. Well, where does the other 350 pounds come from? And what happened to all the bones, beaks, feathers, and all that stuff? Well, it's additives. And they add like soy isolates, salt, sugar, grains, whatever they can sort of pump into it, because that stuff, water, that stuff is cheaper than chicken, all right? So then they charge you to do that service. So your free chicken now sort of comes back to your school at like $5 a pound, you know, because all of the value was in the processing. And it's a trap. And a lot of school districts have fallen into that trap because they no longer have the capability of doing it themselves.
Well, are you saying, though, let me understand what I just said, make sure I heard correctly what you said at the beginning. Are you saying that the government, federal government, I suppose you're talking about at this point, and the state government, whoever.
Fed, mostly.
Fed, mostly, okay. buys X amount of food, X amount of chickens for schools.
Correct.
But instead of the food going to the schools to be cooked, they give it to the processors to extend into fish, into McNuggets or any kind of nuggets, I should say, chicken nuggets, and sold back to the schools.
Right.
Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, but it's up to kind of the discretion of the school as to what you do with that commodity allotment. So if you're a school and you no longer have cooking capabilities, you have to use the product. How do you use the product? The processor, you know, the friendly processor comes to you and says, look, you know, we'll turn your chicken into a finished cooked product for you so you can serve it to your kids. And you're going to have to pay for the shipping back and forth. You're going to have to pay for the warehousing of the product once it's there. And you're going to have to pay us a fee to process it for you. So
right.
now normally we serve our chicken nuggets for sell our chicken nuggets for $5 a pound. But because you're giving us free chicken, we're only going to charge you $4 a pound, right? So it's a complete scam. And this is why more and more school systems are moving back to a cook from scratch model. And this is why I've been preaching the mantra of we need to build a central kitchen here so we can do that.
I'm getting ready to come to the central kitchen in a second. I want to ask you questions about that. And during the course of conversation, as we talk with Tony Jurassic, who's the food nutrition director, who's kind of moving on to more of a consultant's job with the school system and still being here to help things through,
right,
but going to be doing stuff around the country as well. And has been with us now for 2 years. And so we're having this conversation because of Urbanite Radio and the article they wrote about Tony in this issue of Urbanite. But before we get to central kitchen, I mean, so I'm curious if you know historically what happened, why we were down to only 20 kitchens capable of cooking from scratch. When I was a kid, if I recall, I could be wrong, but
we cooked.
I mean, I may not like all the stuff they cooked,
yeah,
but they cooked the stuff. You could smell it cooking
from scratch.
Right.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So look, during the 70s, there were some fast food giants that started standardizing their methods of delivery of their product, right? And part of the standardization of that process was they started preparing a lot of their products offsite and dropping it in because it made more sense for them to control quality and consistency, all right? So over the course of the 70s, the school nutrition programs around the country sort of thought, oh, yeah, well, this makes a lot of sense. But most of this was driven through the food manufacturing communities, all right? Because all of the profitability that is made in the food manufacturing sector is through processing and value add, they call it. All right. So I know this pretty well because I was a broker of the largest chicken processor on the planet for a lot of years. And look, quite honestly, I got pretty wealthy doing that. And I learned a lot about how this works. I mean, nobody knows chicken nuggets better than I do, right? This was sort of one of the reasons why I got
But you don't eat them anymore, do you?
No, I don't. And this is one of the reasons why I got into child nutrition. This is kind of my act of contrition. This is my mea culpa, all right, of trying to undo a lot of the evils that I did early on in my life. And one of the things that I wanted to do was get school systems nationally back to a place where they're cooking food. And not just because it is an act of love to cook a meal for a kid, and a kid knows that. When a kid is walking through that lunch line and a tray of food is served to that child that was cooked from scratch on site by a person that really cares about them, they know that and they respond accordingly. So it's also an opportunity to insert vocational training back into our schools. Look, as a chef, I've had the opportunity to cook around the world. You know, I've cooked from Hartford to Hong Kong. And, you know, I came out of the projects in New Orleans. And, you know, I grew up in a city that that honors food and reveres food. And I was a horrible student, right? I didn't get math until I started taking apart recipes. I didn't get chemistry until I saw bread rise. And it was that that taught me that there was another world that unlocked education for me. You know, and I'm convinced that our hallways are full of these, like, James Beards and Julia Childs that maybe need an opportunity to hear a voice. And look, we Baltimore City Public Schools is a $40 million a year food business. Why aren't we opening the doors to our kids so they're learning this business for jobs and careers?
Let's talk about for a little bit here. I do want to, towards the middle end of our conversation, I talk about some larger food issues in America and our eating and what you think about that. But talking about the place where you've been here with Baltimore City Public Schools, you mentioned the Central Kitchen a minute ago. And I know in our conversations a couple of years back, and our conversations have ensued since that moment, that was one of the cornerstones of your success.
Yeah.
Having a central kitchen where food would be cooked. And I remember you saying, that was the thing about the show we did in the beginning, that we would supply fresh food and we'd have all these central kitchen and we'd deliver it to the schools and you'd have fresh food every day. The schools who can't cook, the food would be delivered there, right. And they would warm it up. It would be fresh, good, wholesome food. So, and I had a sense also that this was one of your biggest frustrations.
Absolutely.
In Baltimore City, is not being able to get this central kitchen started.
Right. And you sensed correctly. You know, this is a thing that I know is imperative for this city and many other cities across America to sort of change the paradigm of the horrible food that we feed our kids in our schools. All right. So we've got to get back to cooking. Over the course of this last school year, my frustration has been known by just about everybody because I'm pretty vocal about stuff like that. I'm not shy when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I want to set the record straight. Look, the Baltimore City Public Schools has been incredibly supportive of these efforts. You know, we've had a couple of big hiccups in our city in the last year also in top tier management in City Hall. So a lot of the work that we got accomplished got sort of taken apart as we started shifting players around the city. And we're in some severe budget constraints right now. But there are alternative ways of building a kitchen and financing it and making that possible. There are a couple of very high profile developers that have stepped up to the plate and said, look, we have properties in East Baltimore that qualify for federal tax credits for the use of historic based buildings. And why don't we build it that way? And so the actual cost of a central kitchen to the city is about 40% of the actual construction cost. Do it on a lease back. And do it creatively, financing this process along the way. Look, I spend $700,000 a year storing my own stuff. $700,000 a year will support a pretty substantial mortgage. So it's by reallocating the money, shifting the money around in a way that makes more sense will work. And I think that until our new CFO, who just came on board, his name is Mike Frist, came on, I didn't have a voice inside of North Avenue or an ear inside of North Avenue that kind of got that in a way that made sense. And Mike Frist is a guy who has stepped up to the plate and said, no, this does work. You know, Alonzo's always been supportive of this stuff, but Alonzo's plate, pretty full. I don't know if you've looked at his plate lately, but yeah, he's always been really supportive of my work.
So it was the politics
of
North Avenue partially that stopped this from happening.
Well, it slowed it down. It hasn't stopped it. All right. So it slowed the process. But I have to say that the response to the recovery of this has been pretty dramatic. I mean, within North Avenue, I mean, people are really working hard to make this thing happen, and it will happen. And that's one of the reasons why I'm going to stay on board here is to make that happen. That's part of my job. My job will be in the development of that central kitchen and get it up and operating.
So your boat stays?
My boat's paid. Look, I paid another year for my slip fee, so I know the folks at Baltimore Marine Center are really happy to hear that.
So you go between your home with your wife in New Hampshire and your boat here in the Inner Harbor?
Yeah. Well, look, my wife thinks me living on the boat in the Inner Harbor just further supports my feral lifestyle. She's right. She's an attorney. She can follow the facts pretty well.
You can't be too feral, man, or you wouldn't be in one piece right now.
Yeah, exactly. Look, Mark, I've said
this
digress.
Before. We digress.
Look, I love my work. I love the work that I'm doing here, and I love the work that is happening nationally. But I'm in love with my wife, you know, and I want to see her more often. She wants to see me more often. And this is the only way I can do it.
And you also have other gigs around the country consulting, people that want to talk about
absolutely.
Where to go with this. And you're committed to seeing Baltimore through, but you've also had some real frustrations. I mean, in your couple of years here, trying to make this thing work. Because some people that would lay at your doorstep saying, well, Tony Gerassi, you know, I said, how much of it is your fault that we didn't get these things? Is it, you know, people would say, did Tony Gerassi not manage it right? Did Tony Gerassi too busy doing other things? Why did we... There's been a lot of critique like laid on you about
absolutely.
Why this hasn't worked.
No, look, I own all of my own shortcomings, and I have a lot
Amen
of them,
that.
All right?
Yes.
I have a lot of them. But I think that in this, in this particular case, I think people need to understand the work that has happened here. I mean, it's monumental stuff. I mean, Baltimore has taken a leadership role nationally that probably no other high-profile urban school district in America has taken on, you know, by even sort of getting to a place where we're saying, what if? What if we did it this way? As an example, when we decided that we were only going to buy Maryland-grown produce, we did, right? We wrote an RFP, and we did it, and we've spent a couple of $1 million over the course of the last year just buying Maryland produce. Like I was at the governor's mansion last Friday kicking off this, Maryland homegrown process. And look, like while other states are building expressways to ship their money away, we are actively building off ramps to keep the money here in Maryland and creating jobs and creating opportunity around that. And other school districts are piggybacking off of the work that Baltimore City has done. Look, we're in the process of launching this Maryland's Best brand, where we've worked with Maryland farmers to contract crop. They're going to grow, you know, specific items for the school systems. And we've got
local farmers are going to do this.
Local Maryland farmers are going to do this. Hanover Foods is going to IQF freeze like all of this stuff. We're going to package it under Maryland's Best brand. And then all of the public schools are going to have access to this at a reduced cost and ensure that our kids get Maryland grown stuff year round. I mean, that's never been done.
No, I think this is an incredible move. So the basic questions about that before we come back again, one with the central kitchen and some other issues. I mean, so how much of the food that our children in the schools consume will that affect? I mean, and how much of that is really going to transform?
Every single meal. I mean, on every single meal that we serve now, there will be some representation of Maryland on that plate. Look, we started a universal free supper program this last year. All right, we're one of 14 states in the country that get to participate in this pilot program. Our vision at Baltimore City Public Schools is to create the very first universal free nutrition program that provides locally grown, freshly prepared food for all of our children, regardless of socioeconomic background, for every single meal, breakfast, lunch, afternoon snack, and supper. And we're already doing breakfast. We're doing supper. Oh, and by the way, our kids are preparing those suppers. Like we have our CTE program, our career technology and education. It's the old Voc training programs. Those kids are actually making the meals. We launched that last fall, and our new director, our new CTE director, Michael Thomas, has been spearheading this and driving it. Like children are making meals for children here. It's not happening any other place in the country. It's happening in Baltimore.
What does it take, though? What is it? You often said things like, in the very beginning, I remember when we first talked, you talked about, you saw Baltimore City Public School System as a $40 million food company. We spend $40 million bucks a year traveling through the school system to purchase food for our children in schools. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
So what does it take to actually turn that ship around so that you're not... I mean, I remember you also made a big deal of that. Well, let me just start with that. Let's stop there. I'll come to the next question that has to do with that. So what does it take to make that vision that you felt when you first arrived in Baltimore a reality for the future, that you take that $40 million, you're actually buying fresh foods and forcing things to be given to our kids the way they should be?
So you need to reinvest in the infrastructure of that food business, right? Which means, professional staff development of people that work within the Baltimore City Public Schools Food and Nutrition Department, bringing on, an operations director that can, take the vision and distill it in a way that it happens in the cafeteria. This program has been not supported in a lot of years, all right? And I can say that honestly and sincerely. When Dr. Alonzo came on board, he got that part of his overall reform package in city schools, you had to include reform in nutrition. Because it's unrealistic to have this expectation that teachers are going to deliver lesson plans and be held to a high level of accountability if kids sitting in front of them are jacked up on sugar or hungry, right? So he got that. I mean, he's a visionary. So in the course of the last 2 years, they've been investing heavily in this department to turn that stuff around. Like any big bureaucracy, shifting that paradigm is slow to happen. I think the president said when he took office that imagine the government is this giant super tanker and it takes like miles and miles and miles for the response from the helm to the rudder to sort of move it around. Well, imagine that super tanker is hijacked by drunken pirates that have no intention of moving the ship, right? And that's the case sometimes, but it's happening. You know, what was a novelty 2 years ago, Mark, is an expectation today, you know?
And people have those expectations.
As they should.
I mean, it part of it has to do, I think, with, well, and we won't dwell too much of this because, I mean, it's sensitive territory, but part of it has to do with the stuff that I know that Andres Alonso has been battling, which is the entrenched bureaucracy that doesn't want to move on North Avenue. Yep. It has a ways of doing things they don't want to change. And the other part are the contractors. I mean, some of these contracts were supposed to be up last year, and you really had the hope that those contracts were going to be ended and you could move ahead with them, but that didn't happen.
I had to fight tooth and nail to change some of those things. And again, they brought in a new CFO. This guy got it.
This guy, Frisk.
Yeah, Mike Frisk, and he's Frisk. Brilliant, all right? So Mike is a former business manager at King of Prussia in Pennsylvania, former retired artillery colonel. Guy is buttoned down, all right? He knows his stuff. He's really sharp business mind, but he also gets that these are our kids and that we work for these kids and that there's no reason why any of us are in that building but for those kids. So let's do the right thing for them. So he's – I now report directly to him, and we've been actively, taking this program apart and reassembling it the way it should have been probably 2 years ago. But it's happening, and it's happening now.
We're talking with Tony Gerassi. Tony Gerassi, this is part of one of our Urbanite Radio series. Tony Gerassi is one of the feature articles about Tony Gerassi is one of the feature articles in this month's Urbanite. Tony is the food and nutrition director, about to stay with our school system but move into a new direction in that school system, overseeing what goes on here. The article in the Urbanite was called Hard to Swallow by Michael Anft, A-N-F-T. It's called Hard to Swallow, School Guru Tony Gerassi Steps Out Amid Dashed Expectations. Of course, he's correcting the record here and talking about what he really thinks he wants to have done, but talking very honestly about what's happening inside the school system. We're going to take a very brief break and come back with Tony Gerassi. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Tony Jurassic is still in the studio here. One of our Urbanite Radio stories, this one based on The Hard to Swallow by Michael Amt, a story about Tony Jurassic and where he's going and what's really happening with our Baltimore City Public School food system. Tony is the food nutrition director. One of the people I first met through you, and it was she was greatly ballyhooed by you and others in this in the beginning of your tenure, was Dr. Antonia Dimas, who was on the show with you, president of Food Studies Institute, and her Food is Elementary program.
Right.
Whatever happened to her and that program and getting and the influence she had in all this?
She's still around and she's still doing some cool stuff. And in fact, her program is still active in several schools across the city. I would love to see that as part of core curriculum in our schools. Like one of the reasons why we did the Great Kids Farm was to have kids understand about origins of food. If you walk the streets of Baltimore, you look at the trash on the ground, that's by and large what kids eat in this city, right? So there's this huge chasm between that trash and real food. So you've got to build some bridges. You've got to get to a place where kids can see where food comes from, that it doesn't come from a bag from the local grocery store. And the Great Kids Farm is a living, teaching tool that demonstrates that for our kids. I mean, we've had, you know, over 3,500 kids take field trips to the Great Kids Farm since we opened it 19 months ago, you know. And I have to give a shout out to Greg Strella, who's my farm manager out there. He's done a phenomenal job. I mean, he's taken the vision that I laid out and executed it and owned it in a way that I don't think a lot of other people could have done. And he's literally made that a national model that now is being replicated across the country. In fact, one of my gigs is working with the Lagasse Foundation in New Orleans to recreate a Great Kids Farm in, you know, urban New Orleans, to do you know, the same thing that we did in Baltimore there, because Baltimore and New Orleans have a lot of similarities.
Lots.
Yeah. And it's like people get that. People get when you like give kids an opportunity to learn in a way that is maybe not traditional, that not only do they embrace it, but they sort of take it steps farther than we could never imagine. Like Lake Clifton School now has hoop houses. These are portable greenhouses over there. And the genesis of that was kids coming out to the Great Kids Farm last summer and learning about food and teaching them how to build this as a sustainable business model. And through partnerships with Safe Healing Foundation and Civic Works here in the city, we were able to sort of build these three hoop houses that now supply the greens and revenue to like change the face of that high school. And we'd like to be able to do that across the city. We'd like to be able to, rather than waiting for stores to open up in neighborhoods that are they're never going to open up in. So let's like dash these food deserts and start building, you know, some green oasis in places that need it the most, you know, and give our kids an opportunity to have a job, a career, and revenue to support that.
Well, I wonder what you think really it takes for us to get there. I mean, one of the things I think that you, I mean,
it's will.
It's will is a big piece of it. I mean, you came here after running a very successful restaurant in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I own six really great restaurants.
And know your food, and then you worked for the devil for a while, and then the food.
Absolutely.
In the chicken processing world,
I have a tail.
And made some money, and came here full of ideas and vision about how to kind of turn around the school system. After you helped do that in New Hampshire in a very small school system, right?
Yep.
So I wonder now that you've had a taste of the reality of a large urban school system, the reality of an entrenched bureaucracy, which is tough to battle your way through sometimes.
And I wholly
And a supportive CEO.
Right.
As well.
Yeah.
Well, talk about what you underestimated and where you think we have to...
Look, I wholly underestimated the bureaucracy, and I'm the first to say that. But like this stuff that we're doing here in Baltimore is getting national attention because it is so far like out of the box that you know, people are taking bits and pieces of this around the country and they're plugging in into their own programs. Chicago, New York, New Haven, California, Portland, Oregon, like this, you know, Denver, Oklahoma City. This is happening all over the country. I just came back. I was a presenter at the National School Nutrition Association's annual conference in Dallas last week. And I'm working with Sam Cass from the White House to do the Chef's Move program, which, by the way, is a program that we've been doing since we've been here in Baltimore. You know, guys like Spike Gerdy and Ned Atwater have been, Reva Khan have been actively in our schools working with our kids for a while. And the White House thinks this is a good idea, so they're launching it nationally, you know. But it's like these kinds of programs are the things that are changing the bar, moving this, you know, slower than I'd like to see, but moving it down a pathway where things will change. Things are going to change. I think I said earlier in the hour that what was an expectation, like fresh peaches on my first day of school, is now, you know, that was a novelty. Today, it's an expectation. We expect fresh fruits and vegetables every meal, every day in our schools, and rightfully so. And we're delivering on that. But it's you know, creating the infrastructure to be able to do that has been pretty monumental because the business model never existed. So you've got to sort of get like growers, producers, distributors to a place where they get this thing and it makes good business sense. I mean, a lot of the big food service contractors around the country, Chartwell's, as an example, like they totally understand this is good business and they're implementing it like system wide nationally. Companies like Bon Appetit, they're part of that Compass Group. I mean, they get it. They're doing this stuff, and it's happening in a big way.
But you have, I mean, you have to be able to make this work, to turn a school system's food service around. Somebody in your position has to be in total control of the finances of that system, or it doesn't work. I mean,
absolutely.
When you said you had a $40 million food company.
That I didn't control the
money. You didn't control. You couldn't kind of, I'm going to come back to the central kitchen, close the deal in the central kitchen. That didn't happen. I mean, for this to turn around, there has to be, that's what has to turn around, is right. How the money is spent.
Right.
And who controls how the money is spent.
Right. And I think that we're at a place now in Baltimore where not only is that happening, but like our business plan is in place to sort of move forward. In the next like 4 to 6 months, we're, you know, identifying the building. We've already identified
the central kitchen now.
Correct.
Right.
We've already identified tax credits. We've already identified developers that are capable of executing the vision. I've spent the last couple of months traveling around the country looking at other central kitchen operations so I can drill down what equipment is necessary, what the placement looks like, what the cost of that is. I just, you know, I brought it with me. You know, I just received another enormous grant from the state of Maryland to purchase equipment to do that. Look, since I've been here, I mean, I've brought in, you know, almost $4 million in grants to build this kind of stuff. That didn't exist before, you know, and it's because we look under every rock. I have a pretty good reputation nationally on delivery, on making things happen. So people are willing to invest in that. And you know, and the money is starting to flow in. Now I've got not only some of the money, but I also have the support behind me from the financial people within BCPS to make this thing happen. School board has been fully supportive of this stuff. You know, it's been hard to sort of, you know, shake that buck loose.
It's very hard. I mean, I think that it's, and that's where the power is, man. One of the things the city paper, excuse me, Michael Amps used to write for the city paper, but one of the things the Urbanite article that he wrote said that it talked about the New Jersey supplier whose contract was up but then was renewed rather than buying Maryland food.
Look, it was like driving like a stake through the heart of a vampire to sort of in that thing, you know? It was difficult. It was hard. And in all fairness to that supplier, there was a need for pre-plate meals because we couldn't cook them. We didn't have that capability. So until I could shake loose the grant funds to buy steam tables and steamers so I could at least start scoop and serving on location, like, they fulfilled the need, all right? Did I think it was the best quality food? Absolutely not. But could I do it myself in the moment? No, I couldn't.
Do you really believe that we could have a school food program that feeds kids decent, healthy food, where a huge portion of it is local, because all of it can't be local, but a huge portion of it can be local, where kids are actually trained in this business, and kind of, some of them, X number, will end up doing the cooking and doing the ordering and doing the work and learning the industry and as a vocation, and that you'll have a central kitchen that can feed the 215 schools of Baltimore, whatever X number of those needs it because they don't have their own kitchens. Do you really think that will happen?
Absolutely. Positively, it will happen, and it will happen in the next year. And not just the Baltimore City Public Schools, but I think that how we're looking at this thing is, so how do we leverage our purchasing power, production power, to create meals from Head Start to hospice? Look, nutrition is important at all stages of life. And I think that by hiring Holly as our new food czar here in the city, that totally underscores that message that Baltimore is serious about changing the game and making this thing different. She was brought on specifically to oversee some of this vision. I mean, my central kitchen was one of several items that were on the sort of hit list of things that we were going to do in Baltimore City. We've got a lot of hungry people in this city, and we've got a lot of people that don't have access to food, period. And the disparity between the haves and the have-nots is great here. So, and if our city is going to be a great city, if we're going to move into the future, we need to start addressing that kind of stuff. And like food, housing, that kind of stuff, those are fundamental things that have to be addressed before any city can sort of achieve greatness again.
So talk a bit about the you mentioned her, the woman who's the new food czar. What, some people have said, oh, how can we afford a food czar? We can't even afford to keep the city afloat. Who is this woman and what's she going
to
do?
How can we afford not to have a food czar is my sort of counter. No. So Holly's salary, I think, is furnished largely by a grant. And
what's her whole name? What's her name?
I always butcher her last name.
All right.
So she's from Baltimore originally. She was working out on the West Coast, food policy person, and she works out of the health department here in the city. Holly's a really bright woman, and she gets that all of these different food systems need to be interconnected. And part of her role is as a connector to help sort of bring some of the fragmented programming that we're doing across the city into one sort of cohesive movement. So we're getting more things done on a broader swipe.
Holly Freistadt.
Yeah,
that's who you're talking.
Holly, and I apologize. Holly, if you're listening, I apologize. I just didn't want to butcher your name.
We're looking forward to having her on this program.
Yeah,
to talk about that, because I think that it's an issue that we don't think about. And so, I mean, because kids, they had those kids quoted in the article talking about how much they still think that the food was terrible, like it was a poly or whatever. That students being quoted.
Yeah, you know, I need to make one comment about that whole article.
Please do.
Look,
the Urbanite Radio Hour.
I am a huge fan of Urbanite.
Me
Urbanite
too.
Was the first rag that I picked up that sort of gave me a roadmap to
the
city.
Our media partners,
right? However, I have to say that the photograph of those kids sitting in front, it's not my food, you know. It didn't come from my kitchens, didn't come from my schools. And I had meetings with those kids, and those kids don't eat in my cafeterias. In fact, they made it a point to say they haven't eaten in my cafeteria since they were freshmen. So I kind of feel bad. In fact, I brought copies of the menus so people can take a look at it so they know that some of the stuff that we're doing, like our Meatless Mondays, you know, huge participation.
So, A, the food in this picture
is not my food.
It's not your food.
Period.
And it
didn't
also
come from my kitchen.
It's also food. Both these kids, like, clearly were, or a supposed picture, they're both picking up forks of food and kind of looking askance
yeah.
at it, right?
Yeah. Look. Again, Mark, I own all of my bad, all right? And I got a bag load of bad, all right? But that kind of stuff, like, you know, wasn't mine, you know? And I just, like, I need to set the story straight. I mean, we've got a lot of kids out there that are eating meals and eating fresh fruits and vegetables that they've never seen or had access to before until this last year, you know? And we're moving ahead. You know, this coming school year will be the very first time in Baltimore's history in probably two decades that our food distributor is a local distributor, that our produce is local, our milk, our bread, all of that stuff comes from Baltimore. It all comes from our area.
Yeah, Maryland. From it.
Yeah.
So having been through so many phases of the food world.
Yeah.
Your whole life.
Yeah.
I had this discussion with somebody who used to do a food show on another station that I know and knows a great deal about food and wine and is doing a series right now. And he said that it's impossible to think we'll ever get to a place in America where all your food is going to be local. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Or from small little farms.
I think that, look, 100 years ago, this is a great stat, right? So the Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Maryland is this guy, Buddy Hance. He's a brilliant guy. You know, I really like this guy. And he's done a lot to sort of change the face of agriculture in the state. But look, 100 years ago, 93% of all of the food consumed in Maryland came from Maryland, right? 100 years later, you know, we're about 8% of the food that we eat comes from this place. Now, you know, the boundaries haven't changed. You know, we're still largely agro-based, but it's the shift in the production that has happened. Like, and one of the great success stories in Maryland has been that we've been able, through Buddy Hance's office, has been able to sort of talk to farmers and say, look, you can make more money on an acre growing broccoli for the school system than you can doing 40 acres of GMO corn or soy for Monsanto.
Rewind that.
Sure.
you're saying to me
the profitability is greater growing fresh fruits and vegetables for the school system than it is growing commodity genetically modified corn and soy for a guy like Monsanto or ConAgra.
Okay, now, so I got to ask this question because, I mean, now you're talking something that I've been kind of playing with in my head for a while.
Yeah.
Because there's a big argument going on about the future of agriculture in America. Clearly, it's one of the things
right.
that is may not be at the on the front pages of the New York Times and the Sun and the Post and the L.A. Times, but the Examiner in San Francisco. But it's there. It's one of the huge issues.
Like food is the next battleground.
So now I am one of these street corner boys. You're a street corner boy too. A street corner
yeah.
boy, but who lives in a little patch of country at the moment.
Right.
In our little patch of country, we're surrounded by fields, and in those fields are hundreds of acres of corn.
Yeah,
and that corn is not for you and me to eat.
No, it's genetically modified corn
that Monsanto or somebody has paid the farmers
to grow.
It goes
into those chicken nuggets that we were talking about. No, I'm being
serious.
You're
right. I know you are. I know. And the other stuff, too.
Yeah.
So what I want to get down to what you just said is, because that's the argument. I mean, I want to know more about what you're saying in terms of the economics of this.
Sure.
That you're actually saying that the old larger scale, perhaps, food and truck farms that grew this stuff could actually make more money doing that.
Absolutely. And more and more farmers are sort of getting to that place where they're understanding that. And more farmers are getting to a place where they understand that that by going back to sort of traditional methods of farming and traditional cropping, that they have more freedom, that they have more economic power, and they're less cogs in the wheel of the food manufacturing industry. You know, it gets really hard for a farmer to hold on to farmland today. Like, farmland is worth more as a housing development than it is as a farm in many communities, right? But it is this agro empire that made this country great, period, you know? And I think that if we kind of get back to that stuff, if we start really, like, putting value on, you know, on our food and our kids, it's like we have a lot of cheap food here, right? And it's because we have a lot of cheap food here that we don't put any value to food. And this is why our kids, you know, are in this crisis of obesity, because you know, manufacturers have run amok, all right? And our kids are the target. Look, 1 in 3 children born after the year 2000 are going to get type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. 1 in 2 African-American or Latino children are going to get this disease, all right?
1 in 2.
Look, you and I grew up in a generation where this planet said polio is ravaging our planet. Collectively as a planet, we said, nonsense. We're not going to let that happen anymore. And we're going to dump everything, every resource that we have available to eradicate it.
And we did.
And we did. All right.
We all got our shots.
All right. So imagine now, like, an entire generation of children are going to die way before their time. And the financial burden of health care to support those kids as they're dying is going to like strip the resources of this nation. And this is largely a curable thing. Like, we just have to start looking at what we eat, how we eat. Look, I come from a place of knowledge, real knowledge, because, you know, I was an insulin-dependent type 2 diabetic for a lot of years. Hmm. And I did it to myself. I had an accident, spent a lot of time in the hospital, and I ran to my comfort zone. My comfort zone was food, right? And, you know, I lived it, I worked it, I breathed it. So I ate it, and I ate everything in sight. And I gained over 100 pounds, man. And I became an insulin-dependent diabetic. And every day, I got up and stuffed a needle in my stomach 4 or 5 times a day, in my thigh, in my arm, checking my blood all day long. And there was a point where I was that food service director at that little school district in New Hampshire, and there was this little boy, 11-year-old boy, was in a nurse's office, and the school nurse called me in to talk to this kid. This kid was in the nurse's office because his fingers were too sore from checking his blood to grip a pencil. All right. And this kid's stomach and legs were black and blue from multiple injection sites. And this kid was crying his eyes out because he didn't understand what was going on. He did everything his parents told him. Right. They had the 6 donuts on the way to school. You know, they had pizza night on Wednesday night. They went to like chicken night. You know, they did all the stuff that he was supposed to do. And now this kid was, you know, a insulin dependent type 2 diabetic, and he didn't get it. Because he did everything his parents asked him to do, all right? Like, I knew what was going on. I was crying because I knew what was going on. I had done it to myself. And that was the tipping point for me to sort of change the way I was doing things. And, it lit a fire under my ass about this, about child nutrition, about why it's important to change the way we do business, why it's important to cook our food again, why it's important to connect our kids with real food. Like, we can do it, or we can lose an entire generation of children. I'm not willing to do that.
So who comes in now to implement what you're talking about? I mean, you'll be there as a guide, a visionary kind of guide for where the school system is going to go. Clearly, you're moving in a different direction that way. So what happens now? Someone's got to...
So our plan is to hire an operations manager. We're interviewing several very talented people from Baltimore, by the way. And from day one, I always thought that it was important that the leadership comes from within. The leadership comes from our city, because these are people that live and breathe and raise their children here, you know. So we're interviewing several people from Baltimore, very qualified people, to do the day-to-day ops. My role is going to be to, like, you know, pull together the finance and pull together some of the other pieces, moving parts, if you will, to get the central kitchen built, and to continue to develop the Baltimore City Public Schools Food and Nutrition Department so they maintain their role as a national leader in this movement. And this is, look, this is guerrilla warfare, man. This is stuff where, like I've received cease and desist letters from the Corn Producers Association, from people that make high fructose corn syrup, to cease and desist. Thank God my wife is an attorney, you know, from like big, you know, factory farms telling me, you know, how dare I, you know, offer meatless Mondays to our kids and things like that. Look, you know, somebody needs to be in front of this thing. And Baltimore has rightfully taken a position of leadership in this country to make some of this stuff happen.
And so I didn't know what to expect today, Tony. I haven't seen you in a bunch of months. Knew that stuff was going on that was tough, but also knew that you were committed to what you displayed. So I wasn't sure where this was going to take us today, yeah, in this conversation.
But I love this town. You know, I love this town for a lot of reasons. Baltimore is a place that gets a lot of knocks, you know, but Baltimore is also a place that that has amazing resources here in the city. And people in Baltimore have embraced these changes in a way that all of the work that has happened, and there has been a bunch of stuff that has happened in the last 2 years, is a direct result of the people of Baltimore rallying behind this thing, you know?
And you also said some things here that are real grist for our mill, just in terms of this notion that you set forth that I really want to look into and under, that we could actually turn agriculture around, farmers could make more money.
Absolutely.
Supplying our public school systems in the state of Maryland with fresh food than they can growing corn for Monsanto and other major.
Yeah. Look, why are we spending our money outside of the state? You know, look, we need the jobs. We need the revenue. We need to keep every dollar that is possible within our community right now. You know, and I know it sounds sort of, you know, isolationist, but it's important that at this time in the history of the state, that we really start looking in our backyard and start figuring out what's best for us and what's best for our children.
Tony Gerassi is a food and nutrition director for our schools, getting ready to be staying with us, but being a consultant and helping to move this thing around. We're going to continue looking at this to see where our central kitchen's going, to see that that's one
will
of the
happen.
key plans in all this, among others. And Tony Gerassi, it's been a pleasure to see you one time again.
Always a pleasure, Mark.
Good
always
to have
a pleasure
you here, man.
To be here.
And I'm glad you're going to have some more time with your wife.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm glad you all were listening to one of our Urbanite radio stories. Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. Find out more at www.hopkinsmedicine.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.